Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Storytelling Festival takes place this weekend and kicks off tonight at Boston Avenue Church, featuring nationally known storytellers, including Jewish teller Corinne Stavish, Tim Tingle, who collects and tells Native American tribal stories, Charlotte Blake Alston, who tells African and African-American stories, and my guest today, Donald Davis, who tells stories from his family and the region surrounding his growing up in Appalachian, North Carolina. Davis is a graduate of Duke University Divinity School and a retired Methodist minister who's been featured at the Smithsonian Institution's Folklife Festival, festivals and concerts around the country. And in fact, he was a guest host for the public radio program Good Evening and gives workshops and storytelling classes. While here, he spoke to the seminarians at Phillips Theological Seminary on the value of good storytelling in ministry, and he'll be featured prominently at the Tulsa Storytelling Festival, which takes place tonight and tomorrow at 7:30 at Boston Avenue Church. Donald Davis is my guest today. Donald Davis, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. It's been a long time, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And you're back here to participate in this attempt to get a Tulsa Storytelling Festival going, which we had one once upon a time, but it sounds like this is a new effort, and there's a great roster of storytellers, and you being chief among them. Now, you're in Appalachians. You're from the Appalachians, you grew up hearing stories. Give us a sense of how you first started hearing stories and how you first became a storyteller.
As a little kid, I never heard the word storytelling used as a good word. It was always something to avoid. But I grew up in two large families in the mountains of North Carolina, and we would go visiting. I mean, we'd go to my grandmother's, we'd go to various aunts and uncles' houses, and I had, I think, 36 aunts and uncles and about 60 cousins. So every time we went visiting, of course, the whole day was just spent talking. And I didn't realize I was hearing stories. People were just, of course, telling what's happened since the last time I saw you. And then about times farther in the past. And I would go back to school and retell some of those things I'd heard. And then people would say, well, tell it again. And I had no idea that I was absorbing this whole, you know, canon of family stories that was the real beginning place of my storytelling.
Now, every family has those stories. Mm-hmm. In fact, in a lot of families, there's almost like this eye-rolling experience. Uncle Bob's going to tell this story again. But I assume it's about absorbing those and telling a lot of those. They're good stories. It's just that you've heard them a bunch of times.
They're wonderful stories, and they're stories that we tell over and over again. Because that's kind of the way we check the role. You know, the people who know the stories already, well, they're part of the family. They belong there. And as soon as somebody says, oh, no, not that again, well, that means they're in the club. You know, they're already there. And so the trick is, how do you tell those stories beyond the family so that they're not only interesting to other people, but so that other people listen to them and say, oh, that reminds me of my mother, or that reminds, and they come back telling another story. So it's kind of like learning how you tell the stories when a prospective son-in-law is visiting who doesn't get it unless you fill out the descriptions, you know, and explain the personalities more. So, you know, gradually in the process of growing up and retelling those stories, they grew and they grew and they grew, not in adding things that didn't happen, but in building the descriptive parts more. You know, you've never been to my grandmother's house, so let me tell you about it. And you've never met old weird Uncle Harold, so let me tell you about him. And then the stories grow. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I began to get phone calls asking me, first one ever was from the Smithsonian, asking me to come and tell stories somebody on their staff had heard me tell just, you know, after a dance going out to get pizza somewhere. And every one of those invitations turned into two and then turned into four, and then it took over my whole life. So now I'm on the road all the time.
Now, I like that idea that family stories are sort of an initiation process. Mm-hmm. It's basically a way to get to know the quirks of the people. Mm-hmm. And also I'm sure most of those stories somewhat exaggerate the quirks, but it also sort of lets the initiatee know what he's in for
It's much more like portrait painting than photography. You know, photography captures brief moments that may be untruth, may be moments of untruth, which is why people, you know, hide from the camera when they're not ready for it. And a portrait attempts to sort of capture the wholeness of life. So an event, which is, that's the kind of thing Grandma always did, it becomes a bigger exaggerated event because it's a portrait of her. And events that were not the kind of thing she always did tend to then drop out and disappear. And you know, the best place you hear that kind of storytelling happening is after a funeral.
Yes. You know,
when people go back to the house. And
right.
Are the stories they're telling all true? Well, they are in a mythic sense because they're true to the personality. And yet what we're doing is we're underlining more firmly the things that were more typical of that person and letting go of the things that were aberrant.
Why do you suppose, and you're absolutely right, the stories after a funeral, when you go back to the house, this is, it's a major part of the grieving process.
It really is.
But it is that time where I think in some cultures, a wake might fulfill that
exactly,
need.
Exactly. You know?
But for, say, in this part of the country, and probably in your part of the country too, it's that meal you take together after the funeral. And the stories just flow. Right. What is it about?
Well, a story is a picture inside our head. You know, when we tell a story, what we're really doing is we're taking a picture that we see inside our head, and we want somebody else to see it. And when we tell it, and all of a sudden they laugh, their laughter's not saying that's funny. Their laughter is saying, I see it. Mm-hmm. Well, then when we gather at a place like after a funeral, what we're doing is we're building the family portrait of the person who's gone. We're building it so they don't disappear from our vision.
The mental scrapbook.
Exactly. They're now in our vision, and we're installing them permanently. So we can tell that story to the grandchildren who aren't born yet, who never knew Grandma, so that they know her. One of my sons is absolutely certain that he knew his Uncle Frank, who died the year before he was born. But he's heard the story so strongly that he knows him completely as a person. And the stories are that powerful.
They really are. I mean, the idea that you can know relatives that you never really knew
very
or
much.
Only maybe knew as a very small toddler, those stories survive. After they're gone, and they become part of the family. Again, it's part of that mental scrapbook.
And we're also working often after death to remember someone in their best days because we've just let go of them not in their best days. And what we want to do is say, this is not the final memory of, you know, of Aunt Mary. The real memory was, remember that picnic we went on, you know, and then we're pulling back her past. We're pulling her back from the heart of her best life.
Yeah, well, that's the power of storytelling.
Yes.
You mentioned that the Smithsonian was among the first people who called you. When you're talking to an audience of strangers, are you telling family stories? At the beginning, were you telling family stories?
I was telling two sorts of stories. On one side of my family, I heard all my family is Scots and Welsh. And on one side, I heard a lot of traditional tales that had come all the way from, you know, the old country. And a lot of those stories were about Jack, who's sort of the everyman character. He's the male fortune seeker.
Yeah, and I think they're referred to as simple and silly Jack stories.
Yeah. Well, we've heard of Jack and the Beanstalk. Well,
right.
There are hundreds of those stories. And Jack is always seeking his fortune. And he usually has two older brothers who are bumblers because they think they know everything. And Jack knows he doesn't know everything. And for that reason, he's open to the kind of help and learning that enables him to win in the end. There are just hundreds of those stories about Jack.
Now, how did those stories come over? Are they almost like stories you tell your kids at night but when you're tucking them in? Or?
Some of them were, and some of them were very adult. Some of them I was never allowed to hear, you know, when I was a child. There's a character in a lot of those stories called a step-husband. You know, and the step-husband is the one who steps in when the husband has stepped out. You know, and you know, we weren't allowed to stay up when they're telling the step-husband stories or those kinds of stories. And they're parallels to the Canterbury Tales. They're parallels to a lot of Grimm stories that were collected in Germany. The name of the main character changes and becomes the most common name of the culture out of which those stories come. So in the British Isles, Jack was the most common name, the nickname for John, the most common name. Mm-hmm. And then there were a lot of stories with female main characters, but most of those stories are about identity loss and recovery. So all of those female main characters had different names.
Mm-hmm.
You can sort of seek your fortune over and over again. That's a male thing. But identity, if you do it right once, you don't.
Identity loss and recovery.
Yeah, well, we'll say Cinderella's a story like that because, she's born the princess and then that's taken
then
she, from
then
her.
Then she's become the charwoman. Yeah.
So how does she rediscover, how does she recover who she was born to be?
Right, Snow White is another
one. Exactly. Uh-huh. And so, again, those stories, the main character often takes the name of the fate that person has fallen into. Cinderella's the cinder girl.
Yeah.
Snow White is the pale-skinned beauty, but is the rival to her stepmother who talks to the mirror on the wall. And so many of those stories. But on the other side of the family, on my dad's side, I didn't hear any of those stories. I just heard family stories. And some of them were tall tales. A lot of them were fool stories that are told inside the family, where, cousins and neighbors are telling stories on each other.
Right.
About what so-and-so's cousin did and what so-and-so's brother did.
Remember
and,
that time yeah, the guy
and
tried to get the truck running?
They're just all about laughter. But then there are stories about times we learn something. And those are the stories, I think, that you can't kill, because those stories identify this is who our family is. We're the family who lived through this. We came from the grandparents who survived that. And so whether it's, storm or in our family, the family home burned, mm-hmm. Or whether it was some kind of accident or illness.
My family was living through the Dust Bowl.
Become big stories. And so we know some people didn't live through it and some people didn't make it. And so that tells the children, you come from a line of people who can make it. You may run into something different, but you have survival genes in you somewhere. And so those are stories that get passed
now,
on.
Now, are those adaptable to a general audience, or are those really family stories?
Well, no, they are adaptable to a general audience because the audience hears them, and the people in those stories remind us of people we know. Mm-hmm. So... When a very simple thing, when in a story that I told yesterday, we've met my mother, and my brother and I are in conflict with my mother. And so that we come to a place in the story where we need to meet my father. And I introduce him simply by saying, my father had one hobby. We called it annoying my mother. And when everybody laughs, they're not saying, hey, that's funny. They're saying, dad's like that.
We know that.
We know that character. We know him. Uh-huh. And so it doesn't matter that it's in a different world at a different time. Now you're following along, building him out of somebody you knew. So,
yeah. Donald Davis is my guest today. He is an Appalachian storyteller and one of the featured tellers at the Tulsa Storytelling Festival, which takes place tonight and tomorrow at 7:30 at Boston Avenue Church. And he's our guest. There'll be storytellers from a variety of cultures that'll be a part of this. And
yes.
Are there common threads between, say, a Jewish storyteller,
oh, yes.
an African-American storyteller,
yes.
maybe somebody telling stories from the Southwest and you from the Appalachians?
Yeah, we have four tellers here this weekend, and I'm from the Appalachians. And Charlotte Blake Alston is an African-American teller from Philadelphia. Tim Tingle is a Native American teller from this part of the world. And Corrine Stavish is a Jewish teller from Michigan, though Corrine grew up in Tulsa. and all of us are we'll be telling stories that come out of our traditions and out of our families. And some of them are very parallel. They may be very, very parallel. There may be stories that come out of holiday time, a meal disaster when company's coming. That happens everywhere. There may be a story about, trying to get rid of my little brother when I was 13 and I didn't need a little brother anymore. That happens again and again and again. Or a story about your first pet and what finally happened to your first pet and what you learned from that. And those happen no matter where you are. So it's that stories are like bridge builders. When we hear somebody's story, our sense is they're more like us than we thought they were. And that's what happens with every story.
You know, it seems like we're undergoing a renaissance of storytelling again. You know, things like The Moth, the Moth Radio Hour and shows that go around. There's a variety of new storytelling. And, right. and a lot of times it's, right. I know there's a former Tulsan that does a thing called Cringe, and it's about your most cringeable moments,
right.
you know.
Yep. Uh-huh.
What do you suppose is accounting for that?
A lot of this is our attempt to get our own brains back. In a world in which we're continually put in situations where we're virtual instead of real.
I mean, that was yeah, my original thought.
That's
was
exactly
like,
it.
I said, where is the future of storytelling going? Because now it's you make a video.
Right.
And put
and
it
so,
on YouTube.
Yeah, and so now what happens is instead of looking at somebody else's pictures, you get to make your own. In a storytelling audience, I come in with nothing. I have no tricks. I have no props. I have no pictures. I just have words. And you take the words and you turn them into pictures of people and places and stories. And you walk out with stories in your head. But you were the co-creator. And I'm honoring the integrity and the power of your imagination. Not saying, oh, look at my picture. How clever. What a nice film I made. How clever, what a good painter I am. I'm saying, no, you're the painter. Well, let me walk you through into this gallery, and you pick up the paints inside your own memory and create the story.
It does seem like, though, that the culture is valuing storytelling less. I mean, you look at Garrison Keillor. Now, there's about 20, 30 years ago, there were a whole bunch of storytellers. John Henry Falk.
Yeah. Gene Shepard, way before Garrison was ever there.
Exactly.
And the old comedians were storytellers, the early comedians. You know, Bill Cosby's early work is all storytelling.
Right.
And then when you go back to Red Skelton, you go back to all those early radio people, they were telling stories. Now what happens is we have to insert commercials so frequently that there's not time to lay out the wholeness of a story.
I was thinking of like the old Tonight Show and old talk shows in television in the 50s and 60s. There, when a celebrity came on, they were expected to tell a story.
Tell a story.
And now it's all, hi, how are you? I'm fine. Right. How are you? That's about it. And it seems like that's a sort of a lost art in many ways, although, I guess I mentioned, there's this new generation trying to reclaim it.
It really is, and what's being discovered is applications of storytelling beyond just the entertainment meeting place. I do lots of work with businesses, and it's everything from working with, say, a family medicine practice where they've hired a medical social worker to run their waiting room. I say, you know, what does this person do? Well, she meets people's needs to tell their stories. You know, she meets them in the waiting room. She talks to them about their family, about their day, about why they're there, and so when they come in to see the primary care person, they're ready to be taken care of because their need to tell their story has been met. And then we find it more and more in marketing and in sales.
I was thinking things like TED Talks.
Yes.
TED Talks are, you know, it could be about heavy science. It could
be
about cooking. It could be about, and basically you're on stage for 15 to 20 minutes telling a story.
Yeah, I'm doing one of those in November. So it's about, and it's going to be about storytelling, of course. So.
Yeah. One of the things you're doing while you're here is you're talking to a group of aspiring ministers at Phillips Seminary.
Right. Yes.
And this is one of the main places a lot of faith traditions hear storytelling on a weekly basis when you go to services at a temple or at a church or probably a mosque as well. Somebody is going to tell you a story that relates to
the faith
tradition.
Yeah. It's all about story because, you know, every faith tradition is based on a story. And if the story's lost, there's nothing left. That's the backbone of everything. And we have to preserve the basic story before we can step out into the implications of the story. And increasingly, we have people, especially when people sort of drop out of church when they go off to college and so forth, and then maybe in their 30s when they have children and they come back to church, one of the questions is, do they know the basic story, not just what we should do with it, but but just the basic story itself. And so being able to tell that in a way that makes it not a museum piece, but something that's alive in the present world, is a big agenda in ministry. Mm. I also work with a lot of criminal trial lawyers, because the best storyteller wins. It's not the person who is the best statistician or the person who has the best maps and diagrams. It's the person who has the best story, and it really is true that's what works there.
Well, let's talk about your work with ministry, because there's two sets of stories. There's the one that you were talking about,
right,
which is basically bringing the biblical lesson,
right,
to life.
Mm-hmm.
But there's usually a story, a personal story that relates to that.
Right.
And to me, that is probably the real trick of...
It's what really works. When we can come up with the parallel story that takes the same thing that was being struggled with in the biblical story and sets it right over into our world today, so that the first thing we discover is there are no new stories. You know, it's a repetition of the same human agenda over and over again. And what can ancient wisdom do to help us so that we don't necessarily have to live through the same things over and over and over and over again? How can we pass on learning through story? And that's the fun part about working with preaching, discovering those stories which plug together and then make that vibrancy just sort of jump up in your face.
Now, you made a bold statement. There are no new stories.
Oh.
There's a million infinite varieties of telling those mm-hmm. stories, but oh. have you ever heard a story that said, wow, I haven't heard one like that before?
No.
Not
after a while. Not after a while. You hear the story, you say, oh, that's like so-and-so.
So
oh,
what
that's
are some
like
of,
this, that's like
what,
that.
What are some of the categories? I mean, you've kind of described a couple of them already, but...
Well, the main category is the unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
When we get up in the morning, we kind of think we know how the day's going to go. You know, we just have a little assumption in our head, this is what I'm going to do today. And if the day really goes that way, there's no story, which is why when the kids come home at night and you say, what happened at school today, the answer is always nothing, because nothing means what happened today was exactly what I expected would happen, and that equals nothing. But some days we get up and we think we know what's going to happen, and during the course of that day, something comes around the corner and turns our expectation on its head. And every time that happens, there's a story there. And so, you know, every one of those expectations is a human expectation. So that's what gets flipped. And it may be negative. It may be accident. It may be illness. It may be betrayal. It may be disappointment. It may be untruth, or they may be positive things. It may be unexpected gift. It may be a wish we never thought would come true, you know, coming true. So there are only so many of those that go around, and then we get them, you know, crossing into each other, because we get things that inside the family, outside the family with friends, outside friends with strangers. Where else do you go? There's three categories of people. So that's why they just run over and over and over again. And when I say to someone, when you're listening to a story, ask yourself three questions. Do the people in this story remind me of anyone I've ever known?
Right.
Does the place where the story happens take me back to any place that's like a place where I've been? Does the happening, you know, the trouble, the inversion, does that remind me of anything that's either happened to me or I watched it happen to somebody else? And I just guarantee you, you can't get through a story without those questions, you know, giving you a positive answer. And there you are, right back in the story again.
And I think the magic of storytelling is that you can hear a story about a very urbanized mm-hmm. Brooklyn Jewish family, and that family has connections to an Appalachian family that grew up in the shadow of the Smoky Mountains.
Or a ranch in Nevada. It's the same. You know, you get the same family and interpersonal dynamics.
And of course, the details are what make the story rich.
Absolutely.
Which could be different to one another.
They could be. The funny thing is, the more specific the details are, the more likely it is that someone else will relate to it.
Mm.
So if somebody just says, I had a dog, but if they say, I had a little Jack Russell whose name was Rose, then that's when people in the audience, you know, everybody that ever had a Jack Russell, now they're relating to it. Everybody who ever had a dog named Rose or even a dog with the flower's name,
female,
they're relating
yeah.
to
oh,
it.
Right.
But if you just generally say, I had a dog, that doesn't make the connection that getting down to that very specific little thing does. A very specific food. If somebody just disliked food, that doesn't make any difference. But if they especially dislike Brussels sprouts, then you've got a section of the audience going with you, you know, right there along the way.
Now, when you were growing up, the family entertainment a lot of times was telling stories.
Yes.
It seems like that doesn't happen as much today.
Yeah,
is that a sad sign?
It is a sad thing. It's a sad thing, but it's also a peculiar thing. I was in a middle school, a girls' middle school in Memphis, and talking with them, I don't know why the question occurred to me, but I said to them, What's the most fun you've had here at school? What's the most fun you've had in the last year? I said, think about it, talk about it a little bit, and then come back and tell me. And they came back and said, the most fun we've had was when the ice storm knocked out the electricity and there was no electricity for 2 days.
Wow.
Said, why was that fun? They said, because we sat in the dark and we told stories. But as long as the power was on, they watched TV. But it was funny to say the most fun they had was when the power disappeared and they were back to their own stories after that. So it's fascinating.
Well, it gives you a sense of the power of storytelling.
It does, yeah.
And you can experience the power of storytelling at the Tulsa Storytelling Festival tonight and tomorrow at 7:30 at Boston Avenue Church. Donald Davis, one of the featured storytellers, you've done everything from, you've told stories on NPR, public radio, and of course everywhere.
Yeah. And I'm at festivals. I'm actually at festivals 42 weekends this year, so. And that runs from coast to coast and beyond.
Well, obviously, the power of the story is still strong. Donald, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Appalachian storyteller Donald Davis speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be one of the featured tellers at the Tulsa Storytelling Festival, which takes place tonight and tomorrow at 7:30 at Boston Avenue Church. For more information on the festival and more information about Davis and the other storytellers, you can visit their website, TulsaStorytellingFestival.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, you can listen online on demand at any time at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa. You can look at our most recent episodes and search our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.